Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden, and I'm glad to be back at the helm tonight. Lawyers play a critical role in sustaining our constitutional democracy. President John F. Kennedy remarked on the enduring commitment needed to maintain such a system of government. Democracy, he said, is never a final achievement. It is a call to untiring effort. At the start of her presidential term in August of 2023, President Mary Smith of the American Bar Association created the Task Force for American Democracy. The deans of more than 100 of America's top law schools wrote a letter in support concerning the training necessary for the next generation of lawyers to sustain our constitutional democracy and the rule of law. The nation's law schools play a critical role in training the next generation of lawyers and upholding the core values of our profession, remarked Heather Gerken, Yale Law School Dean and member of the task force. Through our joint efforts as outlined in the letter, we hope to set an example for our students as we prepare them to carry our democracy forward. Well, we've already talked about forces that threaten democracy, whether they're at play here at home or throughout the world. Are they really taking hold here? Are we feeling leadership is ineffective? Are we not liking the choices we have? Are people feeling too detached from our political leaders? Does our media factor in, or probably our education? Is it disaffection with the elections themselves? Is there some other form of government that's now looking attractive? Even before the polls closed in the 2020 presidential election cycle, former attorney, professor, and advisor to President Trump, John Eastman, on this very program, went on a rant about election fraud. His claim became predicate to efforts to attempt to stop the certification of the presidential election. Some think that it may be because the public has been denied a chance to see the sausage being made, that we will feel better about our democracy if we knew more about the way that votes are counted. Well, perhaps more important than how we get here, how do we make it better? How do we get out of here? What are the things that we can start doing to help people feel better about our democracy? So tonight, we ask yet again, what happened? How did we get here? What's next? And most importantly, what are we going to do about it? You listeners have to get in on this conversation. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Please remember that our guests are here to educate and inform. They're not here to give you legal advice. And the opinions expressed on this station are not necessarily those of KALW, National Public Radio, the Bar Association of San Francisco, or the employers or students that hear from our regular guest. Joining us tonight, we have Task Force member Maria Echevesta, a former U.S. presidential advisor to President Bill Clinton and White House Deputy Chief of Staff during the second Clinton administration. Brent Turner is a civil rights activist specializing in elections. Mr. Turner is a pioneer advocate for open source election systems and regarded as a catalyst for the recently deployed open source systems in New Hampshire and Mississippi. Brent is featured in the award-winning documentary, The Real Activist, with former CIA Director R. James Woolsey. And with that, Maria, Brent, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, Jeff.
You know, let me start with you, Maria. How did you get started and so involved in voting? What brought you to the table?
Well, I would say that there's two. Three, actually. I served in the Clinton administration as deputy chief of staff in the last 2.5 years, and so recall vividly the anxiety and concern of the 2000 election. And one thing that stays with me, and I think is relevant as we think going forward, is I remember taking a cab to the White House, and the cab driver asked, this was before the Supreme Court's decision in Bush v. Gore, asked, what's going to happen? And I said to him, well, the Supreme Court will decide, and we will accept that decision. And he said to me, oh, you don't understand what you have in your country. In my country, there would be bloodshed. There would be violence. You have something very special. And that has always stayed with me. And of course, after that, the Ford Carter Commission was created to look at these election issues. And then Mary Smith, the ABA president, with whom I worked in the Clinton White House, asked me to join the task force. There's so many aspects. One of the things I learned, my husband, Christopher Edley, was on the Ford Carter Commission. And one of the things that I remember him saying is one of our challenges in this country is that every county is administering our elections. We don't have a centralized election system like other countries. And there are pluses and minuses to that. And I'd love to learn from Brent and others what they think about it. But we have a democracy that is an experiment that has allowed an expansion of who gets to be an American. And so democracy is both this ideal, but it's also personal. How does the child of farm workers, immigrant farm workers, from one generation go from the fields of Ventura and Fresno counties to the White House? It can only happen in this country, and it's because of democracy.
You mentioned the Ford Carter Commission. This is truly a bipartisan issue, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about the orientation of the task force you're involved in. It doesn't sound like it was created in response to the activities of any particular candidate or either side from looking at the makeup of it.
It absolutely was not. I think one of the things that we in this country do not really appreciate is the majority, a vast majority of Americans have believed in what we call the rule of law. We have a set of rules. They apply to everyone, regardless of wealth or status. Now, obviously, we're also deeply familiar with the injustices and inequities, but there is still this holy grail of rule of law. And without that rule, we would have, without that belief in agreed upon rules about how we resolve differences and controversies and disputes, we would have chaos. And that's where the ABA and under Mary Smith's leadership to look at this, how can lawyers help both educate the broader public why rule of law and really having those principles that have brought us to this point, why that is so important. And I can speak more about some of the things we did on the task force, but it really comes to that. Let me close with this point. I've had occasion to work in different countries and be very familiar with different forms of government, and not to brag on myself, but I will. I was up for ambassador to Mexico in 2014 by President Obama, but never got confirmed. But one of the things, when you look especially in Latin America, but also in other countries, is the lack of a stable, agreed upon judicial and legal system that allows a peaceful way of resolving disputes. That's something I think Americans have really come to not appreciate.
Brent, let me bring you into the conversation. You heard us talk about, and I'd like both of you to be able to comment on this, but we spoke of the dean's letter and how the deans of 100 of our top law schools wanted to participate in trying to educate younger folks. And that letter came amid some real challenges, some real weariness people had for elections and what was happening. A recent Gallup poll, for example, revealed that only 28% of U.S. adults expressed satisfaction with the state of democracy in the United States. That's a pretty frightening statistic. Well over 2 out of 3 adults expressed some concerns about whether we're truly democratic, whether we should be truly democratic. Is that a sentiment that's shared by our younger folks? And how did we get here?
Well, I don't think social media is helpful necessarily in this circumstance, although maybe moving forward it might be. But certainly the propaganda coming from candidates that dispute the election is relevant here. And the youth, you know, they hear things and it's tough to decipher fact from fiction. So I think that plays in, as you know. And first of all, before I even start, Maria, I want to thank you for your work and for your late husband's work to protect our democracy. The country thanks you for that. And thank you, Jeff, for having this topic on the show. I think it's necessary and important. And to continue, you know, my position has been for 20 plus years now that transparency is our friend, and the security environment available to us, we should move toward with open source voting system software and basically a tightening of the entire election system process. So not to say that there has been issues like in 2020, where there were issues raised regarding paper ballot management and such. We want to make sure that we're taking away any platform from a losing candidate so that they cannot poke holes and throw marbles at the system and encourage this sort of distrust that you're talking about, with 23% thinking that democracy is not in good working order. I think if we start with the elections and make sure they're properly protected from manipulation and that it is a transparent process so that we encourage voter confidence, that's a good initial foundation for the process. Then from there, I think we have our work cut out for us and everything else you mentioned, which was education and, again, social media. It doesn't help when you have an Elon Musk working with a Trump. These are unusual factors that I think we shall overcome. But in the meantime, you know, the perception of the youth should be acknowledged, as you mentioned, and we should really move forward in a lot of different directions. But I think the voting system piece is crucial.
But you're also inviting a slippery slope. You're having a step down at a spot where you're talking about limiting or filtering, at least, what's purely political speech. And somebody at some level is going to have to look at it and say, wait, this is pure fabrication. That invites problems of its own.
If I may.
Please do.
Please.
I think what Brent was describing and the work he's doing And what I learned from the Help America, the Ford Carter Commission, as well as other work I've done over the last 20 years, is, you know, the process of voting should be neutral, nonpartisan. The process itself, that's what's been called into question since the 2020 election in ways that we've never experienced. And part of what we need, how we need to educate our fellow citizens, is that, you know, those poll workers, those are your neighbors. This is at the county level. There's not some nefarious, you know, centralized. And so the fact that, I hate to say it, I actually sat on the Bronx County Board of Elections when I lived in New York. We could have a whole discussion about that. But the process itself should be one where we are all working to be transparent, that everybody knows the rules, and that they are being enforced and followed by everyone. And I think that there's such a mist, what's the word? They're just murkiness that's been fed, to your point, Jeff, about the misinformation, right? Like, that's another subject, like, how do we deal with the misinformation? But I would say, as lawyers, what I think the ABA was trying to do with this task force and others like Brent, and is the process. What do we know about the rules? How do we educate people about how our democracy actually works, and make sure people are fully informed to participate as full citizens?
Let me turn it to Jose from Milpitas. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for taking the call. I want to change gears just for a second, not completely, but just go in a different direction. I'm an adult male, obviously, if you can say that in this day and age. But the NEA, I believe, is a huge problem that needs to be addressed and maybe dismantled because of their disdain for a democratic republic. This goes all the way back to when I was a child in public school, and they used to teach in a way to teach children that, quote unquote, and this is verbatim, Democrats are for the poor and lower middle class, and Republicans are for the rich. I have a child, an adult kid of mine that is a college student, and who shares the curriculum with me and what they teach. I was peeping a Zoom call when it was an instructor teaching via Zoom, who says, and I quote, "Donald Trump is Adolf Hitler, and we're not going to discuss it any further than that." It's a college instructor at a public community college. And this wasn't even a political science class or a class that is about politics or economics or any of the above. I don't think this is appropriate that the NEA, and I do know that this comes from the NEA because I have many friends in D.C. This is coming, and this is a centralized message, so I disagree with the previous statement. There is a centralized effort to wind down our democratic republic and replace it with something else.
Well, let me hit the pause button for a moment. I'd like to give our guests a chance to weigh in on that, but a couple things I'll point out that you've touched upon. One of them is not enjoying the language or the ideas of a college instructor, that's particularly troubling because this is where you're teaching people who are really reaching out to hear opposite points of view. So if a local community college voiced one opinion and they were all uniform with that one opinion, I would find that potentially troubling. But stifling voices are probably worse. And one would hope yes. that that same institution Agreed. Had differing voices, differing opinions, because that's where people learn. But let me turn it to my guests. Maria, why don't I start with you? You've been taking copious notes. I know you're ready to address this.
Well, there's two points I would make. I want to be very clear that when I said there is no centralized system, it is about the process of elections. Other countries have national election commissions where there's a central mechanism for operating and actually implementing the electoral process. We don't have that. It's state by state, and then it's county by county. So I want to be very clear. I was not talking about a centralized message or anything like that. I'm talking about the actual process of making up the rules for when you have to register to vote, how you deposit your ballot. All those things are really state by state, and then you have to go to your county to figure out, okay, when and how and where. But the second point, and to this point of, I'm not going to speak to this regarding the NEA, but to this point of that professor, I agree with Jeff. But here's where I think lawyers are particularly necessary in this discussion. We are trained to understand the other side's viewpoint. And in order to do that, you don't judge it. You don't demean it. You work your very, because you as a lawyer on behalf of your client, whether your client is the government, whether it's a nonprofit, whether it's a corporation, and I've done all three, is to understand what the other side is saying, because you have to have your best arguments to respond to their arguments. And so that's where I think lawyers are in this important role of helping our public understand we can disagree, we have to understand the other's viewpoint, and we need to do it civilly. That is why we have rules. And that is why our democracy right at this moment is in dire need of really understanding what it means to be a country that believes in the rule of law.
Brent, did you want to get on this?
Jeff, I'll just stand by Maria's statement. That was as well put as anyone can do. And we have an intolerance, you know, in this country for certain types of behavior. And I'll just, again, stand with her statement.
When I was in high school, we didn't have the class that was once referred to as civics, but we came pretty close. We had a course called Model Legislature. A huge number of homerooms were brought together to simulate the workings of a legislature. They had a two-party system, not with the same names as the national parties, but they divided us up. We wrote bills. We actually had them debated on the floor. I don't know of schools that really teach that type of thing anymore. I don't know if it's commonplace that most people going through public schools really today have a good idea of what the nuts and bolts of our democracy truly are.
Well, on that point, Jeff, you know, we have a good liaison right now, I think, going into the Bar Association from a more technology-minded perspective, and that's Richard Painter. I don't know if Maria is also familiar with Richard, but a great spokesperson for our democracy and a true advocate for open source software systems in elections. between he and former CIA Director Jim Woolsey, we have a couple people that I think are interfacing with some of the attorneys involved. We do recognize some attorneys will be conflicted by relationships with technology vendors and Microsoft and such, but we want to make sure that the attorneys that are on point have a good working knowledge of the what we consider the next gen systems, the open source system. So we're not just mired in how we got here, which is a long conversation, but how we move forward.
You know, I think, if I may, Jeff, it's what Brett raises is also really important to keep in mind, like so many things. You can have the experts, right? You know, the folks who really understand the technical details, the nuances of a particular process or system. But when we're talking about democracy, we have this added that we have regular people who are feeling, for various reasons, as you've mentioned, a lack of distrust in those systems. And so we have to find this balance of, you can go into the sort of very wonkish, all into the weeds, which is important. And what we need people like Brent and others to really go in the weeds and help translate it for the rest of us. But there's also, to your point about the need for civics education, I mean, it's terrifying how few people, the percentage of Americans who can't name the three branches of government, who don't understand how our let system works in terms of government. Forget there was some, I don't know if it was 10% of young people thought Judge Judy was actually a Supreme Court justice, which was actually pretty frightening.
The more frightening is, as I read it, the numbers were a whole lot higher than 10%.
We just need, like, the technical stuff, yeah, need the experts to be working on it. But what you're trying to do, I hope, Jeff, with this program and what the ABA, ABA did, by the way, was actually conduct a series of listening tours, bipartisan, nonpartisan, in states that are likely to be highly contested because people are that concerned. In Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and we're also setting up additional ones. So it's to listen from people, and that was really important. Hear regular people express their views about what democracy means to them, what they're concerned about, what they're confused about, what they want to know. And the task force will be issuing a set of recommendations in late spring, early summer in 2025. But it's really important to listen to people from where they are coming from.
When we come back from break, I wanted to discuss with you the letter from the deans of the American law schools. And some of the goals that they set forth are phenomenal. They're very, very important. My problem with them is that for many of the students going to law school, this will be the first time that they've seen some of those issues. And I tend to think that it's a great thing to bring people in the profession to a higher level of understanding them, but we need to have some foundation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. And now back to Your Legal Rights.
And yes, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're discussing the future of American democracy. My guests tonight include activist and voting advocate Brent Turner and Maria Echevesta of the Task Force for American Democracy. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about voting, you want to talk about vote counting, you want to talk about democracy. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. So I have in front of me the letter signed by somewhere in the order of 120 of the deans of our top law schools. Schools that we think of as rivals, such as Cal and Berkeley at Cal and Stanford, or USC and UCLA, all joined together. This is so fundamental that people we think of as rivals, people we think of as disagreeing, Republicans, Democrats, everybody comes together on these points. But my concern is when we talk about workshops and events that engage with the rule of law, which I think is an absolute necessity, and teaching people to disagree respectfully and to engage across partisan and ideological divides, again, this is all very positive. I hope that law schools are the first point of entry and that this type of outreach goes beyond law school and starts stemming back to the public schools where people learn some of the fundamentals of our democracy and some of the history that brought us here. I'm getting nodding from both of you, but nobody is speaking.
Okay,
who would like to talk about that?
I'll just jump in because I'm the eldest of seven. Anyway, I think it's really important to note that there have been efforts over the past couple of decades from philanthropy to, in fact, look at how civics is being taught in our public school system, in our K-12 system, because you're right, Jeff. You know, if the first time a law student hears about rule of law, democracy, and civics, that's a bad sign. On the other hand, what I think the dean's letter did was recognize, and this is something nice in so many other aspects of work that I try to do in the education space, there's plenty of work for all of us, right? So the deans issued this letter because they understand that they are training the next generation of lawyers, many of whom will be in positions of influence and leadership. And you mentioned John Eastman. We saw from the 2020 cycle the role that some lawyers took in pushing theories that turned out to be completely groundless, over 40 lawsuits, I think, but that created an aura of questioning and skepticism and distrust. So lawyers have a responsibility to operate at the highest levels of ethics. And so the dean's letter, yes, important, but you're right. We also have to be thinking about what are we teaching in K-12? How are students becoming the critical thinkers to be able to evaluate information from whatever source? That's a different topic.
That is a different topic. And let's be candid, this is such a broad topic that we could make this the first of several shows. But let's circle back to our main point. I would be very interested in hearing some of the steps that the ABA and the task force are doing to kind of get us back on track?
Sure. I mentioned the listening tour, but it was very focused in the states, and they're also working on similar sessions in Arizona, Nevada, Ohio. It was giving talks in the community with a set of volunteers that were bipartisan, recruiting lawyers, local lawyers, right? Because they're often leaders in their community, to explain the rule of law and democracy, to have lawyers work as poll workers, to volunteer in local election information centers, answering voters' election-related questions both before and on election day, touring the local election facilities to learn how elections are actually administered, and then use that knowledge to help defend the process and refute false information. Work to dispel other disinformation that may be coming into the community. And let me stress, it's also to help support our election workers who have been under tremendous attack. I think we've all read various stories, whether it's Arizona, Michigan, Georgia, where election workers who were doing their job of administering the election came under really serious attack and criticism. And really, it's not like they make a lot of money being an election worker. They're doing it because they believe in our community, in our rules, and in our democracy. So how do we support them? So it's both the sort of retail, like how do we respond to what people are expressing on the ground, but also be thinking about how do we have broader recommendations which are coming out in the spring and the summer to try to address some of the things we heard on those listening tours.
That said, is the task force an ongoing effort, or has it run its course?
It is going to go through next summer. We will finish up our work by next summer. And let me stress that point. It's not about issuing a report and then having to sit on the bookshelf. I've been familiar with those throughout my career. There's plenty of work for all of us. I would urge your listeners, if you care about your elections, if you have questions about them, go inform yourself. Go visit your county office board of elections. Go with some friends and, like, what are your questions? And I'm sure, or reach out to your local bar association and find some people who can clarify and inform. Because sometimes we use democracy as like, what makes this experiment so awesome is the notion that one person, one vote. That we, as a county, a community, a state, a country, decide the direction of our government. And by the way, we have been fighting vehemently from the very founding of our country as to what the role of government should be. So this back and forth is not new. And we have always used the electoral process to resolve our disputes. Sometimes one view wins and then another view wins, but it has, until 2020, was always peaceful, except, let's not think, civil war. And, you know, if you get into history, there was also, you know, some fisticuffs on the House of Representatives and other, but compared to other countries, it's been pretty peaceful.
Yes, and we want to certainly keep it that way. I wanted to just, of course, mention the Brooks Brothers riot. That was a little sketchy. I also wanted to, Maria, invite you to maybe co-chair with me a conversation with the attorneys at the ABA, and let's put some of the technologists that are leading us in to the next systems, put them together with the ABA folks, because not only are they competent to build the next gen of systems, they also have great working knowledge of the current systems and can be helpful, not only with system information, but with audit information. So some of these same folks that have been doing the open source election system work have also perfected some audit systems that they did the one in Georgia last time, and I think they'll do the next one. So at least there's smart people in those positions so that the audit process, which may be, again, a crucial element of all this, that is tended to. But I look forward to maybe having a further conversation with you and with your team. And so everybody's on the same team, and that's why we reached out to Richard Painter to maybe have conversation there, and I'd look forward to that with you.
Absolutely. I think, Jeff, if nothing else, is always something I've learned over the years is we often operate in silos, right? And one of the mistakes we're making more often these days is to think that technology is going to solve everything. Jennifer Palka wrote this book, Recoding America, is like, you actually, yes, technology can have many ways to help us address certain issues, but you also need the folks who are deeply knowledgeable about current and existing law and regulations to help bring that together. So Brent, absolutely, I think what you're suggesting makes a lot of sense.
And just for our listeners that might not be as familiar with it, what Brent is advocating is moving from an election system where we get less information about how the votes are tallied and counted, and to one where it's more transparent, where we can see how these tasks were done. We can go back after the fact, almost as if we were counting the individual ballots, just to make sure and put our minds at ease that these things were done right. Is that a fair representation?
It is, Jeff, and just the concept that we don't want corporations in controlling positions for our elections. We want to make sure the people are in the front seat. A corporate vendor can be in the back seat, but they shouldn't be where they are currently in the front seat. So I think that dynamic will change. And I believe due to the work of good people like Christine Pelosi, who assisted this effort in putting it in the California Democratic Party platform, and others that are notable. I want to just mention Alan Deckert, Open Voting Consortium, did some of the foundational work here. And then one of his folks, Ben Adida, is now with Voting Works. They're the 501c3 deploying the systems currently. But the idea is to have a system with open source software, GPL, to get into the weeds a moment, general public license software, open source with a paper ballot, so that if a loser in the future complains that they lost and points to the system as not being transparent, at that point we will be able to diffuse that and have a system that is nonpartisan and subject to oversight. So that's it in a nutshell.
And just to be clear, when we speak of somebody not willing to accept defeat or wanted to challenge it, we're thinking of the last election cycle, the last presidential election cycle. But the fact is, while they took it further trying to block certification, this is not something brand new where somebody questioned. Can you tell us a little bit about times where this has happened before, just so that people don't?
Well, certainly 2000 was an initial point. And then 2004, if you remember, we went to bed with Kerry and woke up with Bush that night. And so now here are these electronic systems coming in, and we have people, you know, the people in Ohio mentioning they were going to deliver the election. And 2016 certainly raised some eyebrows because we had intelligence reports that the Russians were dancing around in the electronic systems, supposedly just in the registration systems, but it's not a far jaunt from there to tabulation. The idea is we want these systems as robust as possible and defensible because we have nation states looking to cause disruption to the country. So, you know, we're on the path there now with initial deployment, but we need these systems to become more ubiquitous, and I think that will happen in the near future.
Let me ask Maria, how do you feel about that as part of the solution? The idea of having open source voting and more of a conversation about how we got from the point where we cast our ballots to the point where they were tabulated.
I absolutely agree with Brent that our electoral systems need to be transparent. Of course, there's going to be, intellectual property, particular voting machines. And now you're just giving me PTSD of when I was on the New York City Board of Elections when we were actually evaluating the use of electronic voting machines back in 1988, 89. But, and yes, you know, people should develop and corporations provide a service or product, and it's, but you need to be transparent because otherwise, how are we going to trust it? And I think the best example of why you need transparency is just what happened in Venezuela recently, where they apparently have a system where their local precincts and there's a count of the actual count of who voted for which president. And those were, because of Maduro, they were not made public because they were in control of the system. And all reports are is that the opposition candidate won and he's fled to Spain. But we need transparency in order to be able to trust the results. And I couldn't agree more because it's kind of scary to think, but we know that human nature being human nature, follow the money.
Thank you.
Is there any solution in sight where we could take some of the money out of our political system?
Are you talking about campaign money?
Campaign
because
money.
Because that's a airwaves? Different... Yeah, that's a different conversation. I'm talking about, I can't even remember the companies, but the companies who build the electronic voting machines and yeah, they're trying to get contracts, right? So when I say follow the money, without transparency, it's quite easy to imagine foul play. So if you can have the kind of audit that Brent is talking about, that's based upon open source, that allows all of us to look at I will continue to believe that we can look at the facts and numbers are numbers and agree, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, that if we're all looking at the same facts, we'll come. And remember, we have squeaker elections up and down the state, across the country, school boards, Congress. We're fixated on the presidential, but this matters overall.
That's right, Maria. And I just wanted to mention to you that the solution systems, the upgraded systems, are first count systems. So you get a higher security environment for the first count, and then the audit follows, yes.
But oh, thank you.
We don't want any proprietary or intellectual property protections anywhere near an election system environment.
Thank you.
That's the idea. Also the registration eventually. And you mentioned New York, so you must also have worked with, we mentioned Bob Nash from the White House in our private conversation, but Doug Kellner In New York. So who is also a proponent of this open source work. Although interestingly, as we've worked with New York State and California, Mississippi, of all places, is the first state to move toward the upgraded systems, and then New Hampshire to follow. But that'll just tell you something about the political will and the lobbyist issue going on here, where California and New York are lagging behind Mississippi. I think that deserves a conversation.
I couldn't agree more.
And, you know, when Brent brings this up on the show, as he has in the past, I always hearken back to a movie which pointed out that it doesn't have to be wrongdoing. It doesn't have to be somebody going out of their way to change the result. It could be ineptitude in the software. And the profit motive of these companies developing the software would be to protect the result rather than examine the result. There was a movie where a talk show host that was clearly modeled after Bill Maher got elected president against the two major candidates. And it turns out it's because one of them had two sets of double consonants in his name, and that upset the software. Are we in any kind of a danger where something so ridiculous could really happen?
I don't believe so now. At this point, we have, and by having this conversation previous to an election, we don't want to dissuade anybody from voting or participating, and we want to be clear about that. The systems are capable, to a grand extent, of conducting an election without fraud and foul play entering into the conversation. But the fact is, we always want to do better. And we know that there's nation states shooting at our systems. So we just want to make sure we're doing our best. And I don't anticipate a meltdown in this coming election. I think there's enough eyeballs on the process at this point that we will make it through. But moving past this election, we certainly want to move quickly toward the next gen. So we get in front of this issue rather than being in response mode.
Right. And I want to underscore that same problem I alluded to earlier about just having, you know, thousands of election agencies, right, doing things slightly differently, actually means that if someone were trying to mastermind a complete, you know,
right.
But it'd just be really, really hard to do. So yeah, this is
decentralization is a positive.
In this particular case,
yes.
We're nearing the end of the broadcast, and I wanted to give each of you a couple minutes for any final remarks you might have or anything you wanted to comment on that we haven't hit thus far. Marie, would you like to go first?
Sure, I'm probably going to sound like I'm on some soapbox, but I'll try not to be, because I think when we use the word democracy, you know, it's a concept, and it means different things to different people. But what I try to underscore for all of us, everyday people, you know, most people do not spend more than 5 minutes thinking about elections or electoral politics or even politics. They're focused on their families. They're focused on, you know, picking up their kids and making sure they've picked up the groceries. And what I want to remind them is that point about this experiment, one person, one vote, and remind people the very time when we were founded, slaves had counted as 3/5 for the purposes of apportionment and did not have the right to vote. Women did not have the right to vote. But our founding documents allowed us to elect people and change our laws so that 250 plus years, we've expanded who gets to be an American, who participates. So democracy is about you as an individual have as an equal voice as, you know, Elon Musk. It doesn't feel like it sometimes for all the other reasons we discussed, but we actually do. When all of us look at our candidates, look at our issues, our ballot initiatives, and exercise that right to vote, we are exerting power. And we need to remember that the power is in us.
Brent, did you want to take about a minute and a half?
Sure. Well, I don't have to. Maria's hard to follow. So I just keep saying, I agree with what she says. I will give some shout outs. I wanted to just say, because we've had, you know, moments of where we were really up against the wall with this issue. And Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director, and Bob both have been great advocates for us. Peter Coyote, interestingly. Also, I want to say just hello to some locals like Fiona Ma, Malia Cohen, Kath Delaney, Alec Bash. These are people that have stood up for this when it was very unpopular to make a stand. And we weren't really clear if the freight train that I saw coming was actually coming. But then 2016 hit. I think everybody got smart then. And then 2020, in sort of a reverse direction with Trump commandeering and pirating the issue, which threw another very unusual spin on all this. So I just want to thank everybody that's helped move it this far. Always my personal heroes, Medgar Evers and his and my adopted mother, Mrs. Merle Evers Williams. Everybody should be thanked for their role in this. We stand on the backs of all, on the shoulders of all these people that have lost their lives and dedicated everything to democracy. So thanks to Maria and thanks to you, Jeff, for hosting.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've examined the future of American democracy. My guest tonight, Maria Echevesta of the Task Force for American Democracy, and activist and voting advocate, Brent Turner. Please join Your Legal Rights, where we are working some of them from very poignant programs. Next week, Islamophobia and the Law. In 2 weeks, a look at the Supreme Court coming year. Then a look at anti-Semitism today. Best of all, we take your calls and answer your questions. That's Your Legal Rights, Wednesdays at 6 o'clock. A big thanks to tonight's guests and to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.